Hello and welcome to the Wellington Halton Hills Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. In this mini-series, we're profiling the people running in the riding of Wellington Halton Hills, which basically surrounds Guelph and has a very unique and different character from our political field here in the Royal City. And on this edition of the podcast, we're going to talk to Dr. Leslie Barron, the Liberal candidate. The history of Wellington Halton Hills as a riding is the history of Michael Chong. The riding was created in 2004, which was Chong's first electoral victory, and he has been victorious ever since. Wellington Halton Hills itself was born out of a redistricting that took pieces of old ridings like Dufferin Peel Wellington Grey, Guelph Wellington, Halton, and Waterloo Wellington ridings, and it's into that political path that you have to find the hope for local Liberal voters when the riding of Halton Peel was then represented by farmer and sometime professional actor Julian Reed from 1993 to 2004. In other words, it is not impossible that a Liberal could win the current riding of Wellington Halton Hills, especially in the more suburban area of Halton Hills, which in the last 20 years has become the outer edge of the suburban GTHA and firmly ensconced in that commuter culture of the region. These are typically the voters that make or break an election and decide who's going to form government. But even as that red wave swept through the GTA in 2015, Wellington Halton Hills stayed firmly blue by nearly 10,000 votes. In other words, the riding itself shows a lot of dedication to Chong, who polling says still has a solid lead on this riding. But the current Liberal candidate, Dr. Leslie Barron, is asking the question, what do the people of Wellington Halton Hills get for this devotion? Chong's reputation as a maverick and an iconoclast hasn't done much for the riding during the Harper years, and then Chong spent a good portion of the last mandate running to be the Conservative Party leader. Have the needs of Wellington Halton Hills been ignored? That's one of the arguments being made by Barron as she's been campaigning this election. Dr. Barron is originally from Ancaster, Ontario. She completed her undergraduate degree in medical school at Western University before moving to Alberta for a surgical training. She then went to the UK and Australia to conduct research in breast cancer and transplant surgery. In 2008, though, she came back to Canada and began work as a general surgeon at Georgetown General Hospital, and she currently lives just north of Georgetown in Limehouse with her husband Simon and her three kids. Now, she's making a play to join Team Trudeau in Ottawa and sit as a member of Parliament. But can she make the case in Chong country? That's one of the questions I put to Dr. Barron on this edition of the Wellington Halton Hills Politicast. We also discuss why she wanted to run for office and how her experience as a doctor and a surgeon helps give her the push to run for office. Barron also talks about environmental policy, why she's running as a Liberal, and why you can't separate social policy from healthcare and other issues. Plus, Dr. Barron will reveal what she would like to do as an MP and what she hopes to get out of the campaign aside, of course, from victory. So I caught up with Leslie Barron earlier this week at her campaign office in Georgetown. So Leslie Barron, thank you for joining me today, or thank you for letting me join you in your splendiferous campaign
office. Thanks, Adam, for coming to Georgetown, your hometown.
Yeah, let's keep that on the down. I'm kidding. Everybody knows. It's well publicized. Why did you want to run for office?
So I think really over the last few years, I have watched politics much more closely. After you get through what I call the hanging on by your fingernails years with small children, I decided to become involved in medical politics. I was sat on the board of the Ontario Medical Association, and then really watched the rise with increasing concern of right-wing populism around the world. Trump here in Canada, Ford in Ontario, Jason Kenney, and now possibly Andrew Scheer. And I think it's time for people to stop complaining and start putting themselves up for these roles. You know, I'm trying to displace the very entrenched conservative in this riding. And it's actually easing my anxiety about politics to know that I can't really do any more right now than I'm already doing, giving people in this riding a good option for a progressive voice, someone who lives in the riding, who works in the riding, who is raising her children in this riding. And, you know, due to the fact that I've looked after, my husband says it between 8 and 10,000 patients in the riding. I mean, I know patients, I've always said as a joke, intimately inside and out, but I look after some really serious illnesses, breast cancer, colon cancer, and you don't look after people from this riding separate from their social situations. Right. Mm. So people who are precariously housed, who are also right. having significant health problems, people who are a caregiver to a spouse, say with dementia, who are concerned what their illness will do, what will happen to their spouse. It's hard not to step forward and say, I would be a good representative for this community.
Is that something that, as a physician, there's more and more studies and things that say that, how we live is tied to how healthy we are. So that's your experience as a physician.
Absolutely. The World Health Organization definition of health is a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease. Mm. And we know that 75% of our health comes from what's called upstream factors, or the social determinants of health. How is the economy doing? Do we have a good job? Do we enjoy our job? Do we have strong social connections to family and friends in our community? Do we have recreation time to enjoy those social connections? These are much more important than access to our healthcare system, which is actually a sick care system designed to catch people once they've already fallen in the river and are floating downstream and have become sick. So, by the time I'm seeing somebody with breast cancer or colon cancer or diverticular disease, it's really too late, right?
Right.
I mean, there are things that we can fix, but often it's a much more pervasive societal measures. The governments have huge influences through their policies on people's health, whether that's climate, economic, tackling income inequality, or gender equity.
That's all that stuff sounds bigger than any one politician or any one doctor.
Correct.
Can handle. It's, I think I approach this all the time in politics, that the problems always seem bigger. The problems are more often than not interrelated. It's like a big ball.
Complex.
It's a big ball of one of those, try to get one wire out of the box and it's tangled with 60 other wires. And how do you handle that? Because you've come at it as a doctor, you're not coming at it as a politician. So when you take the big ball of what sits out of the box and you're trying to untangle it, how do you begin?
So I think the Liberal Party in particular is the one that I've aligned myself with. I should say that before this year, I had never been a member of a political party before, ever. I had never campaigned, volunteered. I'd been pretty focused on completing my medical degree, my surgical career. But the Liberal Party's approach to taking a science-based approach to consultations with expertise, consultations with stakeholders, with those who have a vested interest in policies, is a really important avenue of untangling the complexity of saying from experts, okay, if we implement this policy, what are going to be the intended consequences? What are going to be the unintended consequences? And trying to mitigate. And it's been kind of interesting to be a member of the Liberal Party, and as a very practical centrist person, I find them to be a very practical centrist party. Mm-hmm. They don't get everything perfect, but their policy platform is something I really agree with, and it's been interesting to watch them getting attacked from both sides. You're doing too much, right? Carbon pricing, for example. You're doing too much, you're not doing enough.
Right.
Which often is the way we need to go. In surgery we say the enemy of good is better.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting for you to acknowledge that, because I've heard it from both sides. I've heard the arguments against carbon tax, but I've also heard the arguments from people running for the NDP, people running for the Green Party, who are saying, the targets aren't good enough. Like for reducing greenhouse gases.
I think that's very easy for parties to say who don't have to worry about actually being the government that's governing.
Mm.
Very easy.
So what do you hope to get out of governing? What do you hope to get out of government as a member of parliament?
So I think for this riding particularly, living here, working here, working at the hospital, my kids going to the public schools, driving around, it's been very frustrating to see the lack of attention that is given to this riding, because we are a safe riding.
Mm.
We keep re-electing the same people from the same parties, and I think it would be advantageous for this riding to be a swing riding. If it is going to be a swing riding, it is going to be Liberal. I mean, we're not electing an NDP or a Green or a People's Party member of Parliament in this riding. So I think that's what I'm really trying to present to the people of the riding. When we did the addition to the Georgetown Hospital, The vast majority of the money for that was raised from the community,
mm-hmm.
For our own hospital, mm-hmm. to have, you know, to go from a shoebox sized emergency room to one where we actually have room to move around and look after patients in a much better way. And there's lots of examples of projects that need to be done here. Two of my three kids go to schools without air conditioning. The road I live on ends where it would be nice to have, where I'm very close to two rail crossings where the rail crossing still crosses over the road,
right,
instead of going underneath the road like it does when you drive over to Brampton. So right. I think I'm here to advocate for this riding to get those sort of changes that would help everybody in the riding.
It's interesting because this riding, and I think Guelph is the same way, Guelph has had a liberal, and you may think differently given it's a liberal candidate in Guelph, but I mean that riding's been liberal for almost 30 years,
mm-hmm.
and it just seems like, you know, I seem to remember the Georgetown area being a bellwether. I remember Guelph being a bellwether, and it seems like we've become stuck in our ways.
Yep, and I think when you have an effective member of parliament, I think that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we have effective leadership in this mm-hmm. riding, to be honest.
I do want to talk about your primary competitor, the incumbent, Michael Chong. You know, this is an election where your party is the incumbent. It has the incumbency. You're asking for people to, you know, maybe throw out the, I don't want to say usurper, that sounds kind of bad, but, you know, Michael Chong would be a member of the next likely government. So you're already kind of having an uphill battle.
Correct.
But at the same time, Michael Chong, and I made this point to Ralph Martin when I talked to him, is that, you know, Michael Chong is no ordinary conservative candidate. He's seen as, you know, moderate. He's seen as good on the
not really sure why. His voting record voting record does not, he votes with his party.
Mm-hmm.
He has voted against liberal policies, and when Stephen Harper was in power, he voted with. So I'm not sure that is a deserved reputation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see him standing up for gender equity. I don't see him standing up for scientific literacy. I don't see him standing up for legislation like medical aid in dying that, you know, has relieved a lot of anxiety and suffering at the end of life. I didn't see him standing up for evidence-based decision-making around decriminalizing marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
He voted against a conservative senator's bill that would have banned advertising sugary junk foods to children. Again, evidence-based policy making. I know as a parent, it's hard for me to keep sugar out of my kids' diets. And we are, you know, an educated, well-resourced family. There is absolutely, should not have been anything partisan about that. Yeah, it is an uphill battle. Incumbency comes with a massive advantage. But again, like I said, it's easing my anxiety to know that I am giving the people in this riding a good option for change.
Is it an option they might accept, though? Because I think, you know, unless somebody decides to step down and it's an open riding, it's a bit harder. And I'm sure you're aware of that, too. But, you know,
incumbency is
yeah.
a massive advantage. You
and reputation is everything. You know, you make good points. Yeah. He's you know, voted with his party, perhaps against, you know, and, you know, the evidence to the contrary. But, you know, he does have that reputation as a maverick. And reputation is harder to vault than running on the facts sometimes.
Yeah, so, you know, the issue of him having a fight with Stephen Harper at the beginning of Harper's tenure is one that he uses to his advantage. I think it did no good to the people of the riding. I mean, if you were going to pick a hill to die on as an MP, why don't you pick something that actually matters to the people in the riding? The wording of Québécois versus Quebecers is not something that I have heard mentioned at the thousands of doors that I have knocked on. And unfortunately, that led to him being kicked to the back benches. If he really wanted to pick it as a hill to die, he should have resigned from his party, number one. And number two, like, pick something that matters to the people here. It resulted, again, even though his party was in power, I feel like this riding again got ignored for the 10 years while his party was in power. It's very frustrating.
So how do you circle that square? I mean, you're talking about going to the doors. What are people telling you? First of all, you know, maybe what they like about Michael Chong? What or and you know maybe what are they looking for?
They can't actually name a policy of his that they like or his parties. So it really is something that's just kind of floating around there. I mean, like I said, his voting record when it comes to voting on bills that are harmful to people is terrible. His voting record is appalling. You know, voting against carbon pricing, a very centrist approach, revenue neutral carbon pricing. 8 out of 10 people receive more back in revenues than they actually have taken away from them. We know it's a Nobel Prize winning strategy. So yeah, I have to go back to the policies. I think if this was an election of about policies, and unfortunately it doesn't appear to be, that this would be easier than it is. And I, you know, I think when we look at the riding as a whole, people are, particularly down here in Halton Hills, are tired of somebody who's having somebody who is invisible or is doing things to further their own leadership aspirations and not working for the people of the riding.
Talk about covering the riding, because it's a massive area.
It's 5 municipalities.
Right.
Correct.
It's, yep. And it surrounds Guelph too, which makes me laugh. But it strikes me too that, you know, it's the whole spectrum. You have very dense, like the suburban area here in Georgetown. You go into Acton, it's kind of suburban and rural. Then you go further out and it's even more rural. So, you know, what's the common ground in a riding like this that you've found?
So people are worried in this riding about affordability, and particularly about housing affordability. It doesn't really matter where you are in this riding. Housing is unaffordable. And so I think that would be one of my top priorities, particularly seniors housing. Obviously, I look after a lot of people who are older. My mom lives in the riding. We have been through that, down that road with her, with the issues around seniors housing, people aging out of their own homes, not able to look after themselves. Where do they go? Supportive housing options. In my mom's case, we had to sell the house in Ancaster that I grew up in. She moved up here to Georgetown, and unfortunately her care needs increased, and she now still lives in the riding, and she's now up in Fergus. So the campaign has actually been a good chance. When I go up there to Dornoch, I stop in and see her, and then carry on. So I'm hearing a lot about affordability. You know, people are worried about climate change, but I have to say affordability and housing are much higher on people's minds. Obviously, I talk a lot about healthcare. I don't know that that's an issue that's really on people's minds. I'm not sure why, because it's obviously one of my reasons that I'm running is to protect the Canadian single-payer healthcare system.
Right.
When I start talking about it, people definitely not in agreement, but it seems to be not something. I think our healthcare system, you know, we have a lot of issues that are fixable within our healthcare system, but it, because of the people that work within it are so dedicated, we do tend to look after people when they need it. And I think that has resulted, unfortunately, in a bit of complacency around the Canadian single-payer model of healthcare. People are perking up to the idea that we don't have access to family doctors. People move into this community and cannot find a family doctor. And as a specialist, that is not okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Liberal government is the only one that has pledged to work with the provinces to make sure that the 5 million Canadians without a family doctor get access to a family doctor or primary care through a nurse practitioner. That's so important. You know, access to pharmacare. The Liberals know that this is going to be hard, right? We have lots of Conservative premiers. We have to negotiate healthcare through them, through the health accords. And so it's going to be a negotiation, and we're not getting pharmacare by 2020. It's just not going to happen. It's going to be an ongoing negotiation with the provinces about getting universal pharmacare, which Canada desperately needs.
It strikes me, working with the premiers, that's going to be easier said than done. Have you given a lot of thought about that?
So I was, like I said, I was on the board of the Ontario Medical Association. So I am aware of that's the body that negotiates physicians' pay with the provincial government. So I am aware of all the issues there. I think it's about finding common ground, really, of moving forward in a way that benefits physicians and patients in the system. And often those things are actually cost effective. We know that it is much more cost effective for people to have a family doctor that they have an ongoing relationship with than if they are using emergency rooms and walk-in clinics. So there's lots of areas of common ground with most governments that we can agree on.
Yeah, family doctors. And I know this from my own, not my own personal experience, but someone in my family's experience. The family doctor is the first line of defense. And as a specialist, you...
The whole system breaks. As a specialist, yeah. The whole system breaks down when you do not have access to a family doctor or a nurse practitioner who knows you, who has your record to refer to. I think at this point, half of my referrals for gallbladder removals actually come from the emergency room at the Georgetown Hospital. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, is a canary in the coal mine, right, saying there is something wrong with the system. I have elderly patients who move here to be close to families who cannot find a family doctor in Georgetown.
Right.
And that is not okay. We need to think about the school board model of providing primary care, where you move into an area and a body, like a family health team, or a LIN or a sub-LIN is responsible for finding you primary care.
Mm-hmm.
People don't move their children into an area and the school says, no, I'm sorry, we're full. But right. That happens daily in the Ontario healthcare system. And it is not okay for people to be driving back to Whitby or Peterborough or Hamilton to see their family doctor there unless they choose to do that.
I mean, it's a great point because I don't know anyone who's ever moved somewhere had their kid enrolled in school and said, no, the school is full.
Yeah.
That's
not just my idea. That idea comes out of the Price-Baker report, which was a report commissioned by the Liberal government in Ontario in 2015 on the state of primary care.
Mm-hmm. But again, that's, you know, looking at what the province is doing, at least the province of Ontario, you know, merging LINs, gathering together services.
They're not really gathering together services.
Yeah.
They've gone with this Ontario health team model. Nobody really knows what it is. They mm-hmm. haven't set goalposts for what the goals are for Ontario health teams. They are generally already well-resourced academic health teams. They're going to fix a small number of problems for a small number of people in Ontario. They are not a comprehensive vision for Ontario's healthcare, and my vision for that would be that everybody has access to primary care.
Right. And that's not, I mean, that too is automatically setting up a fight, because if the Liberals form government again, you're talking about these solutions that require a lot of, you know, finesse, require a lot of negotiation, and in some essence, expanding services. And that's, you know, that's going to be a hard sell, especially with...
Well, you don't necessarily need to expand services.
If
we can keep people who can see their doctor out of emergency rooms, out of walk-in clinics, there is the potential to save quite a lot of money.
Okay. I want to talk a bit about the environment because, one of the things I noticed from my time living here is lack of transit. And I never particularly wanted a license. I never particularly wanted to own a car. So this was not an ideal place for me.
It's a huge problem for this riding.
Right. And it's just, again, the vastness of the riding. I did observe this in looking at research on this riding, but, you know, the Council of Halton Hills passed, like, a thing, I was going to say an amendment, but it was not an amendment, but they passed a resolution that, you know, we're in a climate emergency and we need to act. And
yeah, I was there at the meeting.
Oh, were you at
the meeting?
I was
at the meeting, yep. I spoke to it.
Okay.
In support of it. Yep.
The obvious question is, how can you respond to the emergency without the most basic, what I think is maybe one of the most basic solutions?
So you've talked about complexity, and
yeah.
This is where we're getting into complexity. So in Georgetown, we continue to build single family homes on farmland. With that kind of sprawl, it is very difficult to build walkability into our communities. So active transport options are great. We need bike lanes. We need to look at how we're building our communities. We know that people's quality of life is increased when they can walk to a store, when they can walk to their school, when they can walk to work. So those sort of solutions are really important. I had lots of meetings in downtown Toronto. I've been on the GO train when it's been canceled.
Yeah.
You missed the last one, so you have to drive over to Mount Pleasant. That train's canceled too, so they put you on a GO bus. Yeah, our public transit is good for the environment. It's good for people. I would like to see more urban planning. I think we are really at the edge of urban sprawl in the GTA. Georgetown and Halton Hills, this riding will join urban sprawl. And we are a commuter town. We have lots of people going into places like Mississauga, Malton, Etobicoke for work. And we definitely need to improve our public transit system. Right now we have commuter trains that leave between 4:45 and 8 in the morning and come back in the evening, and that is it. If I want to take my kids down to go to the CN Tower on a weekend, I am not left with a lot of options,
right,
unfortunately, for public transit. So this is an area where the towns need to work with the provinces and the federal government. We need to make it easy for people to do the right thing. And the sad thing is, when you take the GO train, you honestly don't save yourself a lot of time. And sometimes you don't even save yourself money because the service is quite slow. We have very few express trains. So if we want to make a service that people will use, you know, things like the Conservatives have proposed with tax breaks for people using GO Transit,
right,
have not been shown to increase ridership. We have to provide people with a better service if we're going to increase ridership.
You mentioned that it is on the minds of people here. Is it also on their minds that, you know, maybe they have to give up the car, maybe they have to give up, you know, something, whether that's paying more in the form of a carbon tax? Because I think one of the things that at least I've been seeing in this election is that there's a conversation about greater awareness in the environment. People love Greta, people love the message, but when it comes to
The hard choices,
that's right. Yeah.
So I think that's why you need carbon pricing. Money is the great determiner of value, and you are using money and behavioral economics to try to drive people towards making the right decisions for the environment, okay? I mean, I use a reusable mug, I drive an electric car, I bike to work, I'm vegetarian, we have rain barrels. It's not enough. We must have government action. You either have to have cap and trade at the industry side, industry makes products that consumers buy, or you have to have carbon pricing. You can't do it through a regulatory approach. That is just nonsense coming from the Conservative government. Their plan is just a nod and a wink to climate change.
Mm-hmm. Then I am curious about how that translates, though, to the people, because the polls are showing that people want to take, people say action is needed, but they personally do not want to be the enactors.
Yeah,
and
that's the tough sell.
Yeah. In this.
Yeah, and that's why the carbon pricing that the Liberal government has brought in, again, getting attacked from both the right and the left, you're doing too much, you're not doing enough, is revenue neutral. 8 out of 10 Canadians will get more back than they pay, and that is a really fair way to ease the burden. We know that wealthy people have larger carbon footprints. They live in bigger houses, they drive larger cars, they buy more stuff. And so this is Nobel Prize winning economic way. And the quote that I keep using is, if you're trying to treat climate change without carbon pricing, is like trying to treat diabetes without insulin. It's going to be ineffective and dangerous.
Mm-hmm. What about industry?
So we had cap and trade that targeted the industry. We had a massively successful cap and trade system introduced by the Wynne government. It was in cooperation with both California and Quebec, and it was scrapped by the Ford government. If we had kept that system, it would not have been necessary for the Trudeau government to implement or impose carbon pricing in Ontario. Mm-hmm. But the federal government views climate change as, you know, a significant threat to our health, to our environment, to our economy in the coming decades, and that is why they went ahead with that. And the Ford government has spent millions fighting the federal government in court over revenue neutral carbon pricing, right? And lying about it too. Right. Andrew Scheer has lied about the effect of carbon pricing in British Columbia. So we need people, unfortunately, these concepts, sometimes it takes a lot of time to explain them, but I think I think people can understand that we need to put a price on pollution. And then they don't have to worry so much about what exactly it is that they're doing in their daily lives. If you want to live a low carbon lifestyle, then that's fine. Don't use plastic straws, buy an electric car. But we need incentives to get people into things like electric cars, to make cycling lanes so that people feel safe to bike to work instead of using their cars. All of these things, I mean, carbon pricing is by far the biggest tool in our toolbox to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions and get ourselves to the Paris goals.
So would you say that message is getting out there? I mean, from what you're hearing?
I think it is. The green vote in this riding has been a little bit frustrating, to be honest, because we have an incumbent, and we've already talked about the fact that I'm up against a very entrenched incumbent. That's already difficult. And then on the other side of it, I'm fighting against a green vote where the their goals of going carbon neutral by getting rid of the Green Party platform by getting rid of nuclear energy is just not practical. I mean, that's a complete fairy tale. We are not getting anywhere close to carbon neutral in this country without the use of nuclear power. 50 to 70% of the power that powers Ontario at any given time is nuclear. So I don't even agree with their platform. A Chatelaine article from a climate scientist and economist that was released last week gave the Green Party platform an A for ambition and a D for feasibility, gave the Liberal Party platform a B for ambition but an A for feasibility. Is this something that people are willing to accept in their lives to fight climate change? And I think that's, again, why I'm a member of the Liberal Party, because they've been very honest with Canadians about what they're doing. They've done it. Justin Trudeau's recent analysis was that the Liberal Party fulfilled 92% of their campaign promises. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And unfortunately, a Green vote in this riding will send a Conservative back to Ottawa to repeal carbon pricing. I think that is something that people are going to have to, in this riding who vote Green, are going to have to wake up and reconcile with for themselves on October the 22nd. I am running because of climate change, because I want to push our government and the Liberal Party to do more on climate change.
Okay. Maybe to wrap up, I like to ask this question sometimes. Aside from becoming the next MP for Wellington Halton Hills, when you wake up on October 22nd, what do you hope to have gotten out of this campaign, and what lessons do you think you'll take with you?
Well, it's my first time in politics, so there's been a lot of lessons that have been learned. I think we're going to be really proud of the campaign that we've run. So I will definitely take all of that experience. Depending on what happens, I will have obviously long conversations with my family about what happens next. If I don't win, I'm very lucky. I get to go back to a job that I love, working and living in the community that I'm now a part of. And the other thing I think that I will take away from this is that, the kids that live in this riding know me as a surgeon. They know that a woman can be a surgeon, can be a mom, can go to soccer games and hockey games and do all of those things. And so being a role model, and being a role model for now for all of the girls and the kids in the riding who know now that women should put their names forward. They shouldn't be scared of getting into politics. I have a very thick skin. I'm in a male-dominated profession where women aren't treated very nicely. I think politics is the same, but I don't think that that should scare women away from being involved in politics, for standing up for their communities.
And doctors never go out of business.
What's that? Correct. Yes. Unfortunately, my work is always increasing. So.
Well, we'll let you get back to it. Leslie Barron, thank you so much for your time today.
Okay. Thanks for the interview.
And once again, that was Dr. Leslie Barron, the Liberal candidate for Wellington Halton Hills. And if you'd like to learn more about her and her campaign, you can find that information fairly easily at her website, lesliebarron.liberal.ca. And we'll try to do one more of these podcasts before Election Day with one of the three remaining candidates I haven't had yet a chance to talk to. Aside from that, that's it for this edition of the Wellington Halton Hills Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics, Ed Sindale. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify, or you can download it from the host, Podbean, at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. Also, when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonson or at Guelph Politico. There's, of course, the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. And until then, see you next time.